This is Linux Journal Insider for issue 195, Linux in the Enterprise. This is July 2010. I'm Sean Powers, here with Kyle Rankin. Kyle, how have you been?
I've been busy, man. Busy just keeping my enterprise running, actually. So, how about yourself?
I also make it so. No, I've tried really hard not to make Star Trek references this year because last year I did. But no, this year I'll tell you what. You know, this podcast was supposed to be recorded last night, but here in the northern part of the Lower Peninsula of Michigan, it's been hot, absurdly hot, like close to 100 degrees in May.
That is insane. Yeah, it's been in the 70s out here. It's been wonderful, so I can't even imagine what it would be like.
Well, it's like the 70s, only about 25 degrees hotter. We can write a script to figure that out. But no, and in fact, I asked Kyle yesterday if we could do the podcast in a time where I could purchase and install a window air conditioner, because the headphones on my head made my ears sweat, and I didn't even know that ears could sweat. But I authoritatively know now that ears can sweat. So, so yeah. Anyway, now that we've grossed everybody out.
When you gross ear sweat. Yeah.
When I get older, maybe the hair will help absorb that. No, but
it'll help wick away the moisture. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's gross. Let's move on. So, yeah, I was going to say something horrible, like speaking of old people, but no.
Actually, we could talk about the fact that hopefully, you know, you probably have really sunny days right now. Hopefully you'll get a little bit of cloud cover, maybe partially or fully cloudy, that will.
Oh, yes. And speaking of clouds, I was actually thinking of a way to, you know, intro Bill Childers, or pick on him, whichever.
Never mind. Let's do your segue instead. I like that one better.
No. We'll stick with your segue and just pick on Bill the entire article. How's that?
Excellent.
All right. So the first article we're talking about is how to build your own cloud with Eucalyptus. It's by Bill Childers, our friend and cloudy person, who just loves the cloud and all things cloudy. We should call him Winnie the Pooh, maybe. Just a little black rain cloud. No, anyway, Eucalyptus, though, it's this article talks about setting up your own cloud. And all joking aside, it's kind of cool. You know, the most popular, possibly, cloud environment would be the Amazon cloud system, correct? The Amazon E2. Is it E2? Is that, I always forget.
EC2.
I always mess up their initials and stuff. But the EC2 interface to set up your own servers online, you can actually host your own cloud running Ubuntu server, and it's just an option. During the install of Ubuntu server, you can set up your own little clouds where you set up extra nodes and grow your cloud as you need to grow it. I haven't actually set up my own cloud. And Kyle and I were talking before the podcast that it's kind of a unique scenario that you'd want to do this. You know, if you were a big company and, you know, you would normally pay money to Amazon to spin up servers for development or, you know, that kind of a thing, you can actually host it in-house and save quite a bit of money. Because Amazon EC2, while it's cool, it's not terribly cheap.
Well, yeah, especially if you run all of your instances all the time. It's one thing if you bring them up, tear them down, it can be somewhat inexpensive. But if you actually use them all the time, like a regular co-load server, then yeah, the price can be about as much as it would be for a regular server running all the time.
Exactly.
Now I've actually set this up myself just to try out Eucalyptus Cloud, and I was surprised at how easy it was to set up. The installer that Ubuntu sets up for this is really intuitive, easy to follow. You start the installer, it will do a detection to see whether there's the nodes that you need are present, and it's pretty much automatically configures most things. And all the extra steps you need, Bill sort of goes over here in this article. So
he does. He walks you through. Simple. Yeah, he walks you through setting the whole thing up. And one other thing that's neat to know about the Eucalyptus Cloud is that you can actually use tools designed to control the Amazon EC2 cloud infrastructure, and you can control your own Eucalyptus Cloud. Correct? I mean, did you try that?
Yeah, I didn't actually point it at the Eucalyptus cloud, but yeah, you can use similar tools to just, you point it straight at your private cloud and you can manage it the same exact way. Now I noticed that he created a system called Falcon. Now I'm assuming, I'm looking at all of his screenshots here, and I'm assuming that's because a falcon is a bird that flies in the clouds, unless it's like Falcon Crest or something.
Yeah, let's pretend it's Falcon Crest because that's much funnier. So Bill really, really enjoys his evening soap operas. In fact, I wonder if he has a, I wonder if he has a database of all those evening soap operas.
Well, I tell you, if he did, hopefully he would be able to, you know, replicate that performance somewhere else. And then the next article is about MySQL replication. And it's written by Mike Nugent, who is no relation to Ted Nugent, or so I've heard. I haven't confirmed that with the DNA test.
You know, Ted Nugent lives right up in my area or has a house up here, so I could ask him if you want.
Oh, yeah, next time you run into him. So have you seen him around there?
Driving around. I haven't, like, you know, had tea and crumpets or anything with him. But, you know, he used to drive this big zebra, like, truck thing all over the place. And he played Ted Nugent music, so.
he played his own music?
I don't know if that's true. The truck was true, the music not so much. But anyway, MySQL replication.
Yeah, so this article, Mike goes into a number of different ways to replicate MySQL. And so what we're talking about here is the fact that as you start to scale an enterprise that uses MySQL as the backend, what you'll find is you get to a point where either for reliability reasons or because you basically max out whatever server you have your database running on, and you realize, oh, I basically need to scale this across multiple databases on multiple servers. But then the problem is, well, how do I make sure that all of my data is on both data? If I have two databases, how do I make sure that they are both stay in sync? Well, he goes over a number of different methods that you can use to keep the databases in sync. He goes over some of the pros and cons and talks about some of the things that troubles you'll run into when you set up like a master-master relationship, master-slave relationship. And talks about NDB clusters. He basically goes over every single kind here and then walks you through all of the steps that you would want to set up so that you can set up this replication. And goes really in depth. In fact, I've been considering setting up something like this for myself, just as on some of my personal servers. So I see myself referring to this article pretty soon here.
That's really cool. And you know, whether you're replicating SQL or you just want to sync data back and forth, one of the things that Canonical, the company behind Ubuntu, has been doing is their new Ubuntu One syncing technology, and what they're using on the back end is actually CouchDB, which is a non-SQL or a NoSQL non-relational database scheme. And our next article actually is by Daniel Bartholomew, and he talks about SQL versus NoSQL. They're kind of different things. Now, a lot of database people will argue one over the other or why one is good and one is bad, but I really see them as separate entities. You know, there are some data sets that really make sense to have in a relational database and some things that just make sense to have, you know, just keyed up so that you can retrieve them quickly. CouchDB is what Canonical is using in Ubuntu One. I know that Reuven Lerner's been going over MongoDB DB along with CouchDB in the past few issues. And these are, you know, just I just see them as very different structures. For example, Kyle, you were talking before the podcast that sometimes in your Perl scripting, you'll just dump a bunch of, you know, text into a quote-unquote text-based, you know, file database. Whereas you could speed that process up, it's not relational information, but if it was in a non-relational database, you'd be able to access that quicker and be able to scale things a lot better.
Yeah, it's a lot faster a lot of times. A lot of things that you need to store really are just key value pairs. And so while there's certain advantages to having relational databases, and this article goes over all of those, sometimes for certain applications, it's way more effort and for not much gain to think of all of the relational structures you need to build in the database when instead you really just have a bunch of key value pairs and you just want to store them maybe temporarily sometimes or for a long term, but you just want to store them quickly in a database and then retrieve them later.
Mm-hmm. And those values can be drastically different. You know, I mean, it can be anywhere from, you know, what files you're talking. Like, again, I'm going back to this whole cloud thing. Maybe I'm sounding like Bill, but you know, there are a lot of things that, like you said, just make sense to do in a non-relational, just quick, you know, key value pair. I like that terminology, to retrieve the data quickly at a later time. So I think this article clears up a lot of misconceptions as to what the, you know, it's not necessarily one is better than the other. It's that they're different, and you could even, you know, use one in a circumstance to do the other's job, but sometimes one is clearer and makes more sense.
Right. I mean, basically what it comes down to is that, you know, people think of regular relational databases as the classic database that you would use in the enterprise. But in fact, you find that both databases are databases that are now being used in the enterprise. And again, open source databases here that you're using in enterprise, but not without some challenges, which brings me to my next article that I'm going to talk about. So by Avi Deicher, and this it's titled The Challenges of Open Source in the Enterprise. And what this article goes over is more of a high-level approach to aimed at all of us who are working with Linux in the enterprise or open source software in the enterprise, how to navigate the fact that not everybody else that works in your company loves Linux, loves open source, or maybe gets open source or cares one way or the other about open source.
Right. And now, just before, I actually really wanted you to cover this because it makes more sense. You're in an enterprise environment. In the environment that I'm in, a lot of times the dollar will dictate, you know, cooperation with the open source world. But you work in an environment that money isn't necessarily the motivating factor as to why you would choose one over the other. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, you know, there's always an upper limit to what you want to spend on things. But in many cases, what it comes down to is whether you're getting the best thing. You know, when you're trying to set up a big infrastructure, a lot of times you're not necessarily trying to cut costs as much as you're trying to build the best solution. And sometimes it's open source. And depending on what you're talking about, unfortunately, sometimes there's not the best open source solution for that particular problem. And this article goes over in good detail a lot of examples of both cases. Talks about when Linux and open source software makes a lot of sense, when it makes a little, where in other cases where, yes, it makes sense maybe for your personal setup, but once you get to the enterprise level, there can be some challenges, like, for example, doing fast routers. So I went to a talk at LinuxCon last year about making your own 10 gig router in Linux using basically off-the-shelf almost Linux hardware and all the challenges that the guy went into. And the point was that he could build a Linux 10-gig router that could more or less do routing at line speed for maybe, you know, $6,000-$7,000 instead of, you know, like $50,000-$60,000 that you may pay for a 10-gig router that's from a main company. But there's a lot of challenges and a lot of difficulties that he went into trying to build that too. So, like, this article sort of has a very practical approach to knowing when it's a good idea and when it's not, and also how to deal with all the other people in your organization that may or may not agree with you, and how to convince them when open source is the right solution.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, that leads us into our mailbag. Normally, we pick a letter out of the letters of the editor to the editor, and we read them out loud and respond to them. Well, this week or this month, as I was looking through the issue, it's going to be interesting, and everybody probably the first thing they're going to do is turn to this page. But on page 15, I wrote a small little piece. It's called Repo Man, right? And in there, there's a screenshot of the apt-get cow. Do you know the apt-get cow, Kyle? You know apt-get moo, and it prints the cow on the screen?
Well, oh, yeah.
I took a screenshot of that because it looks cool, right? And I put it on there. And as I'm looking at the page, I noticed that my terminal window had transparency set. And you can actually see in the background the things on my desktop. Now, thankfully, I wasn't doing anything inappropriate. But in the background, well, I guess that depends on who you ask. But in the background, you can see that there's a terminal window open, SSH'd into a server. There is a dialog box on a bum, 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 a Macintosh machine that's open
you sure this,
in the back.
You sure this wasn't a screenshot of Bill's desktop or something? You sure this is? Is this you, Sean?
I understand what you're saying. I know. But again, in my day job, I'm blessed to administer about 50% Linux machines, but the other 50% is Macintosh environment. So my laptop is running that. But I thought instead of reading one of the regular letters that we already have in the magazine, I would read a letter that I'm going to get probably 50 times as soon as this hits newsstands. All right? I get this letter all the time anyway, but I thought that it would be good just to do a preemptive letter to the editor. All right? So, Dear Mr. Powers, on page 15 of the July issue, I noticed in your screenshot of the apt-get cow that in the background there appears to be a Macintosh dialog box. I am shocked and offended that you pretend to support open source ideals and yet obviously use and enjoy proprietary software. How can I look at you the same now that I know you're such a hypocrite? Do you also have dinner with Bill Gates on a regular basis? How can you look at yourself in the mirror? Signed, Ashamed I Follow You on Twitter. Well, ashamed? No, sure, this is a little bit of a joke, but I really do. I get hate mail, and I'm sure Bill probably does too, because, you know, we use multiple operating systems, even though we love and adore Linux. Even you, Kyle, who is the Linux-y geekiest person I know, even at your job, you're required to use Windows. Is that true?
That's true. Yeah, I have one Windows desktop that I have to have because we use a lot of enterprise VMware, and they haven't released a Linux management tool for it. So basically, they have a piece of software called Virtual Center, and the only way to run that is to run it on a Windows machine, and that's really the only way that you can manage the software. So yeah, I have to have a Windows machine open. So, luckily, but my keyboard is connected to my Linux machine, and then I just get to the other one through Synergy.
Right, I understand. Yeah, and you know, on my desk at work, you know, I have multiple machines. But I guess the reason I really want to bring this out, and maybe I won't get letters about it at all, but you know, if you're blessed enough to be able to use 100% Linux in your environment, you are definitely part of the minority. I'm just thankful that. Linux is one of the main things that I can use on a daily basis. And I just thought it was funny that the screenshot happens to show in the background. I looked really close. I was a little bit worried that, you know, there might be something back there incriminating, you know, like maybe an American Idol video playing or something. But there's nothing that horrible. So anyway, with that, I suppose that wraps up. This went kind of quick for me. I don't know. I guess that wraps up this episode of Linux Journal Insider for July 2010. Make sure that you pick up a copy on newsstands in mid-June. And subscribers, if you're listening to this, you probably already have a copy of this and you're looking at the apt-get cow on page 15 right now. Next month is the Cool Projects issue, so we hope that you tune in again. And don't forget to visit us all month, every day, all day, at linuxjournal.com. See you next time, Kyle.
See you next time.